Reading the first couple of pages of this book, it's a very good book, The Christian Kabbalah, which is basically a study of the impact of the Kabbalah on Christian Europe during the Renaissance. We'll have a lot to say about that, because in fact, it played a key role, that is, magic played an important role in the overthrow of ancient science and the beginning of modern science. For example, one of the weirdest and probably most important characters in the story of the history of medicine is Paracelsus, who is strange beyond belief, but we'll get to that a little bit later. But he has a fairly good beginning summary, so I will. I'm just reading from the introduction to this book that I did not reproduce. Religious belief may be taken seriously or casually. If it is taken casually, it provides a ready solution to any questions which may arise in the life of the individual. If it is taken seriously, it creates problems. Not the problems of the skeptical, leading to the formulation of a rational philosophy, but those of the faithful. True religion, as Bennett points out, begins in a doubt. But the doubt which religion generates is a doubt about the moral relation of the human soul to God. The alternative with which it torments man is not that of God or no God, but that of God remote or of God near at hand. This is a problem of religious sophisticates. To the religiously naive, God's presence is a fact, not a problem. It is a dogma, not a doubt. Religious seriousness commences with a problem created of the distrust of dogma. The solution of the problem may lead to the reaffirmation of the traditional or orthodox creed. It may lead to that form of religious individualism which we call mysticism. It may lead to the development of an idiosyncratic intellectual construct which satisfies the believer better than simple faith. Those who accept this construct feel themselves set apart from their fellows. They consider themselves to have penetrated more deeply into hidden mysteries. They believe that they are the elect. It is to this type of formulation that the term occultism is applied. An occult formulation can develop in any religion. It can best be described as a distortion by exaggerated emphasis of the tradition within which it arose. Thus, although occultism is not orthodox, it is seldom heretical. It vociferates rather than challenges the basic principles of the religion which gave it birth. Within the Jewish tradition, three major doctrines have received occult emphasis. The doctrine of the transcendence of God, that of the literal inspiration of the scriptures, and that of the redemption of mankind through the Messiah, son of David. All of these doctrines are characteristic of the Jewish culture, although at various times in Jewish history, modifications may have entered from other cultures with which the Jews were in contact.
He said Messiah, son of David, before they were...
He's referring to the Mashiach that's yet to come, not the Lubavitcher.
No, I'm talking about... Did you consider Jesus?
No, the Christians will have, not the Jews.
He's
at the moment describing the occult construct within Judaism.
The first one transcendence of God.
That God is not a physical object, something that's beyond the natural world, above and beyond the natural. Superior to the natural world. No, he says that these are major doctrines which have received occult emphasis. He doesn't say that the doctrine in and of itself is occult. He says that these are three major doctrines of Judaism which have received in the course of time occult emphasis. In the folkloristic narratives of Genesis, the presence of God is taken for granted. This anthropomorphic deity represents a thoroughly naive conception by thoroughly simple folk. If he walks in the garden in the cool of day, it is not to be marveled at. Those, etc., etc. The concept of God became more refined and more remote and less human. The prophetic theology, as stabilized into dogmatic formulation by the Prushim and by the Pharisees, presented a God supremely eminent. The Palestinian mind was not, however, metaphysical. No matter how exalted God became, he was never conceived as transcendent. His superiority to men in no way affected his direct participation in the government of the world. God's relation to the Jewish people has always been near, and the Jews have looked forward to the day in which that close relationship would be extended to all the peoples of the earth. The very simple devices were used in the Bible to rationalize the discrepancy between the eminent God and his imminent activities. Whereas the rationalization took the form of calling Abraham the friend of God or describing Moses as seeing God face to face, while the people waited at the foot of the mountain, or asserting that the Jews were chosen people, the explanations are of an extremely uncritical nature, not those of the religiously sophisticated. Even in the relatively sophisticated setting of the book of Job, the Lord, speaking from close at hand, out of the whirlwind, defends himself against the charge of mismanagement by asserting his enemy. Not until the Jew was placed in a philosophically keener environment in Alexandria did the concept of transcendence, towards which the Jewish view of God had been unconsciously moving, enter openly into the theological picture. Not until then was the reconciliation of the two aspects of God by reason rather than by faith necessary. The problem of serious religion, of which Bennett spoke in the passage quoted earlier, became acute. The solution proposed by Philo of Alexandria was elaborated along the general lines of middle Platonic thought. It took the form of a theory of emanation. In later Jewish thinkers, such as the Karai, Benjamin of Nahalin, the aspect of transcendence was stressed almost to the exclusion of the aspect of immanence. This led to an increasing need for the adaptation of the Philonic system by providing that both the creation and the government of the world be carried on by means of intermediaries who are themselves creations rather than emanations, but whose power emanates from God. In the form of the doctrine of the Sefirot, emanation theory became central to Kabbalistic thought. The Sefirot combine both aspects of previous emanation theories. They reveal God to the earnest seeker through gradually more exalted attributes, and thus provide a way for man to God, and they are also the intermediaries by means of which God's intervention in human affairs takes place, and thus they provide a way for God to man. And then he goes on to discuss the other two things, the literal interpretation of the scriptures and the thing of the Messiah. Okay. Now, we're mainly interested, as I said in this year, on the impact that Kabbalistic thinking has had on the halacha. And for that, we have to take a look at the rather different attitudes that the Kabbalistic view takes towards mitzvot, those that say the rationalist take towards mitzvot. If we take a look on page 138 in tonight's handout, this is an article by Professor Gottlieb, which I brought on the suggestion of Danny Langerman. This is his essay on Ramban from Kubal, where he's in the second paragraph on the left-hand side, he's discussing the difference between the philosophical and Kabbalistic attitudes towards the reasons for mitzvot. It seems to me that we can differentiate. The 93 of the article, my 138. Okay. That we can differentiate that the explanation of the reasons for the mitzvot on the part of philosophic Judaism, and especially of the Rambam, differs from that of the Mekubalim at their very origin. According to the Rambam, the source for the Tamei HaMitzvot is man himself. The commandments were given to him in order to guide him to perfection, and the nature of the mitzvot were established from an understanding of man's nature and taking into account this nature. In other words, the purpose of the mitzvot, according to the philosophers, if you can talk about Tamei HaMitzvot at all, if you don't simply take the attitude that we're just simply to obey without any reason whatsoever, but if there is any reason for the mitzvot, they have to do with man. They're there for the perfection of man. For example, a large number of the mitzvot were established in order to take into account the views of the nation at the time when the commandments were given. The Rambam makes that very point, most famously, in his explanation for the reasons for Karbanot. Theoretically, it would be nice to eliminate animal sacrifice from religion altogether, But at the time the Torah was given, everybody, the only form of religious service was animal sacrifice, and therefore, in order to wean the people away from idolatry, a compromise had to be made, and animals had to be sacrificed to God also. So that therefore, from the Rambam's perspective, the mitzvot are man-oriented. They're directed towards the improvement of the nature of man. Okay? On the other hand, he says, in the Kabbalistic explanation, the nature of the mitzvot have to do with the substantial quality of the mitzvah. The mitzvot are not commandments without any reason, but their source is also not didactic, not educational, in order to educate the man. Their origin lies in the cosmic powers and the hidden forces that the commandments have to influence these powers. When by means of fulfilling the mitzvot properly, man is able to change the direction of the world. Or to put it even more bluntly and more decisively than Gottlieb does, the purpose of the mitzvot from the Kabbalistic point of view is to influence the structure of what's happening within the divine realm, within the Godhead himself. By somehow or other performing a mitzvah, you're fixing something that's missing within the structure of the Sefirot or within the structure of God. So every single mitzvah that you're performing is not to your own benefit as a person or your own education, but rather has a theurgic, somewhere between a magical and a theurgic function.
Where does this idea come in?
Where does it come in?
Yeah.
Well, it certainly originated at the time that the Kabbalah originated. That is, we'll trace some of its history when we go back to look at the Sefer HaBahir or other such early books of the Kabbalah, but the perspective is completely different. If I'm performing a mitzvah, I know if I'm putting on tefillin in the morning because it reminds me of my duties and it's an educational function, that's one thing. If I'm putting on tefillin in the morning because God also puts on tefillin, and that's taken seriously, and by putting on tefillin somehow I'm affecting the balance of power within the cosmic realm, this is a completely different perspective. It's a mix, it's somewhere between magic and theurgy, where I guess the difference, I would say, between the two is that in magic you're interested in deriving immediate benefit to yourself, and in the more theurgical aspect, what you're trying to do is help God out, or help the divine realm out, or help the cosmos as a whole function.
You say, well, you should not take the seat of that. Is that what you're like to go? Is that similar? Maybe participation in God's creation?
That, you see, has a very rationalistic interpretation, namely that you're bettering the world. Another function of the mitzvot may be not only to better you individually, but you yourself can improve society. Yeah, but that's a very rationalistic attitude. Namely, improving the world means social consequences. You're improving society. Communism. Improving the state, the society as a whole. You're interested in the benefit of the structure of the society as a whole. We'll make this clear very soon as to how this is going to differentiate. I'll do a case study of how this makes a big difference in a minute. First of all, let me introduce a character here, because he will play a passive role. And on my page 144, this is part of a long shiva that we will study later in Yer Sashem, having to do with the issue of putting on tefillin during Kol HaMoed. But this is a shuvah of the Rabbi Menachem Azariah de Fano, who is a contemporary of the Marshal, 16th century figure, and I'm reminding you that in the 16th century, until now there's a rebirth, of course, but in the 16th century, that was one of the heydays of the Kabbalah and had a great influence on all of Christian Europe and on the development of science, not just simply something within Judaism. But whereas in Christian Europe it was a passing fad, it has never lost its appeal. Okay, so now if we take a look in the left-hand column, just I want to point out to you, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines from the bottom in the left-hand column. V'gam harav Shlomo de Luria. Remember we read the Marshal's tshuva last week, who said that even if Rav Shimon ben Yochai himself would come in to tell us something, we wouldn't pay attention to it because the law is not like it. So the Marshal refused to accept the authority of the Zohar, and even if Rav Shimon ben Yochai, when it contradicted established halachic decisions. He writes about him, Ashir hayagadat sheken yachod sumayinotav. He was a great man. Aval b'tshuvatav siman tzadikhet, that we read last week, svatav davot atak v'drushim halalu v'ga'ava u'vuz. There he's just talking shameful and prideful things. Vadai ani hayav yoto sha'ah. Certainly at that time he was impoverished. It's not even fitting to respond to anyone who should dare challenge the authority of the Zohar. So here you can see a key conflict between an Italian Kabbalist on the one hand and a Polish halachist on the other. Of course, they both came from quite different cultures, as we will see. Okay, now, the issue I want to discuss is very simple. Beards. Are we supposed to have a beard? I have a beard.
You don't have a beard.
Well, you used to. Okay, what is the role of the beard? Are Jews obligated to wear beards? Minna? Let's first take a look at how the Zohar deals with the issue of beards. Okay. Some are, I think majority are not. Well, don't count. Okay. Alright, some of this material is a bit shocking, but I hope we're all adults. The beard of the king is the most important of all. Supernal chesed and gvura commence from the head. The light of the father and mother is divided. The light of the father into three lights, that of the mother into two, making five in all. Chesed and gvura are comprised in one light, making six. Chesed subsequently crowned itself and shone with two shining lights, making eight, and Gura was illuminated with one, making nine, and the lights are all joined together, they are called the beard of the king. And then it was written, the Lord will go forth as a mighty man, he will arouse jealousy like a man of war. Okay? What? Not shocking? I'm reading all of these are citations from the Zohar. That one is... 2. What? Well, I think it'll become pretty clear. For the holy name comes from forth from oil to bless and kindle the light. What is this oil symbolizing? It represents the same good oil upon the head that ran down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard. The symbol of blessing, the instrument of which was the high priest. Rabbi Eliezer held that it represents the supernal mountains of pure balsam. Okay. Or here from the Zohar Vayikra, section 3. So in the So in the exposition of the verse, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is the Lord is one," we have learned that one signifies the community of Israel who clings to the Holy One, blessed be He. As Rabbi Simon said, the union of male and female is called one. The Holy One, blessed be He, be calling one only in the place where the female also is. Since the male without the female is called half the body, and half is not one. When, however, the two halves are united, they become one body and are called one. At the present day, the Holy One, blessed be He, is not called one. The inner reason is that the community of Israel is in exile. And the Holy One, blessed be He, has ascended aloft, and the union has been broken, so the Holy Name is not complete, and is therefore not called one. When will it will be called one? When the Matrona will again be with the King, and they shall be united. When, in the words of the prophet, the kingdom shall belong to Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the kingdom referred to the community of Israel to whom the kingship is attached. Then in that day shall the Lord be one and His name one. The verse continues, "It is like the precious oil upon the head that ran down upon the beard. This is the oil of anointing of holiness which streams forth from the ancient Holy One and which is found in the supernal stream which gives rise to the children wherewithal to kindle the light." In other words, there's a union of the male and female aspects, the sexual congress of the male and female aspects of the Godhead is the complete unity, and then the emanation filters down into the lower aspects of the Godhead via the hairs of the beard. So, okay? Or, here's another quotation. When the king joins the Matrona, the crown ascends and settles on the head of the Matrona. Then there comes down a supernal crown studded with all kinds of precious stones and with garlands of lilies around it. The supernal mother crowns him with that crown and etc., etc. Oh, yes. Then the mother silently sends down noble gifts and fixes them in that crown, which thereupon lets fall streams of oil of holy anointing upon the head of the king, whence it flows down onto his precious beard, and from there onto the garments of the king. So the role of the beard is very clear. It's part of the process of emanation. By shaving your beard, maybe even by trimming it, you have interfered with the divine aspects of emanation. Yeah, but your beard influences what God's beard is doing. No. No, but that is the origin of the Kabbalistic antagonist reason for demanding the wearing of beards. Now, in fact, did Jews wear beards? But that's not what the Zohar is telling.
Oh, at the time in Hebrew origins, that was just a part of your face, part of your body.
Fine. Therefore, but it's not the. But after all, if the shaving of your beard, if the commandment to wear a beard is one which in fact affects the higher realms and the emanations and all of those things, then it's a serious business. If it's only a custom, as you say, then there is no reason why you should or should not wear a beard. It depends upon the style. So, you being a rationalist and not a Kabbalist, think that the wearing of a beard is purely a matter of custom. Abraham Lincoln
style
versus Bill Clinton. And right. So, that means that you're not particularly subscribing to the Kabbalistic view. And in fact, there's a lot of support for that. Here's another, I managed to gather together some, so here's another two pages. And let's start with my page 177 and see indeed what the custom was for Jews as far as wearing beards are concerned. We know that there's a commandment in the Torah which said that you're not allowed to shave the corners of your face with a razor. That's an explicit prohibition. and there are plenty of them. Just one page is just two sides. I don't need one.
Oh, yeah. Bring one back.
Okay. Okay. And someone like the Rambam might have interpreted this as having something to do with not following some particular idolatrous practice or this or that or the other. But of course, from the Kabbalistic point of view, the shaving of the beard is an entirely different offense. Now let's see what the actual practices were. First, here's a Rosh in Makot, where theoretically we're only supposed to not allowed to use a razor here, 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 and here, the five or however many corners of the actual face. The Rosh says, V'yorei shamayim yitzei yidei kulam, someone who wants to be particularly strict should worry about all possible definitions of where the corner and therefore you should not use a razor anywhere on his face. Not like those who leave a tiny little thin growth around the various peyot and shave with, presumably with a razor, the rest of their face. Because he can't be too careful to see that he's not shaving in the wrong place. So obviously, in Toledo at the time, there was a large group of people who would actually shave, and indeed with a razor, except leaving a little thin line around the corner. And here's the Radak. Even earlier, I should put him up before the Rush. Remember that David sent some envoys to Ammon to a funeral, and they were seized as spies, and half their face was shaved, half their beard was shaved, and David told them to sit in Yericho until their beard grew back in. Well, what would happen to you if someone shaved half your beard? What would you do? You'd shave the other half, right? So that's what the Radak asked. Why did they have to wait in Jericho until their beard grew back in? Why didn't they just shave the other half and appear reasonable? V'lo yamar l'galeach ha-chatzi ha-acher, ki lo hayam in hagam l'galeach ha-zakam, ba'afilu b'misparayim. Their custom, that is, the custom in the time of King David, was not to shave their beard, even with a scissors. Ela hasafam levad, ela imkein v'shemtsa v'aveh. Kmo she'amam u'gulachei zakan u'kurei v'gadim. V'cherpa haya yuduach ha-zakan. Ela she'nahagu kein v'ela ratzot ha-shanachnu sham. In our land it's customary to shave, not to wear a beard. Therefore, for us it would have made sense to simply remove the other half of the beard. But in the time of David, so this is exactly as Mr. Weinstein describes it, namely, it depends upon what the local styles are. And the local styles of in the 12th century, where the Radak was living, where was that, in southern France or someplace like that, was to shave. Okay, here's the tshuva of the Truma Kadesha. Tshuva. Yira'ed yeshva. Should not it be prohibited to shave the beard with scissors? There is some basis for being somewhat strict. The people don't worry about this. In other words, everyone does use the scissors and cut that when they do use the scissors to cut their beard, that the lower blade, the one that's next to the skin, should be stationary. Because there's a problem that if you are moving the bottom one, then you may actually be shaving with half the scissors rather than cutting the beard. So therefore, one should be careful that when you're using a scissors, that the upper blade be the one that's in motion. Shema ira shelo yichtach zug elyon el v'tachton v'hu kemo ta'ar kama shana. V'hinei kashem ma'od liyot nizhar v'dar hazeh. Amnam nireh benachon liyizahar shelo yisaper ba'at hazakam ad mitzvayim shu chadud ma'od. You can take care of this, but not by using a scissors that's not overly sharp. V'lek elamecha shiyachtoch ha'tachton v'lo elyon el kishu chadud ma'od. The only time where there's a danger that the scissors will act as a razor is if it's an extremely sharp one. אבל אם אינו חדוד, אי אפשר לתחתון ולי דיבוק העליון, אני לא יודע מי אתה תכתב. So therefore, he's willing to tolerate the custom. In other words, in Vienna in the 15th century, the Jews were not wearing beards. Clear. And this is, of course, brought in the Shulchan Aruch. אינו חייב על השחטת הזקן אלא בתער, ומספריים מותר אפילו כאין תער. ומכל מקום נזהרים כמשתפים במספריים שיעשה היקף הגילוח בחלק העליון מן המספרות ולא בתחתון. Okay, etc. And just quoting the now, there's something even more interesting. Here's a tshuva of the Chatam Sofer. Now, the Chatam Sofer was certainly not a liberal. He was the leading opponent of any kind of innovation or reform. So, the first or third of the 19th century, he was active, I think he died in 1839, and he was active from the late 1790s to 1839. But he was the major opponent of the reform movement and the leading posek in all of Europe, but certainly completely recognized throughout the European, the Ashkenazic European world as the leading halakhic authority. All right. Asher malei piv tochachot kadosh yomalo. He's writing to his correspondent. This is only one page from a rather long tshuva. Uvadai kenu v'kama min hagim shenit kalkulu eitzel hamonim v'naseh lahem heter v'avonotein harab. There's certainly many degenerations of customs amongst our popular. Aval asher sam panav neged medulachei hazakan, the fact that you're attacking those people who go around clean shaving, lo yadati ma rash hagadol hazeh. Why are you making such a fuss attacking people who are clean shaven? L'chu navi bini vachacha. Let's debate this point. Im yishum chukat hagoyim, if you think that a Jew is and it's supposed to wear a beard in order that he look different, appear different from a non-Jew. The Shas mentioned in a number of places that wearing black shoes or black laced shoes was a sign of being a non-Jew. The Jews didn't wear black laces in their shoes or black shoes. Now everybody wears black shoes. Where did we, why do you allow that? Why don't you make a fuss over that instead of the beard? That a person tried to appear that he was either not Jewish or not religious, and he was actually wearing black shoes. והוא הדבר הלא נמצא בשעס ופוסקים ולא בשום ספר מספרי חצרים שיהי הפרש בין ישראל לאינו ישראל בגילוח חזקה. Nowhere do we, and anywhere in the literature do we find that there was a distinction between Jews and non-Jews as far as wearing a beard was concerned. כי אז גם כל אומות המגדלים זקניהם. At that time, as Mr. Weinstein said, the non-Jews also used to wear beards. V'yayin v'shas shabbos kufnum beis kalat amadish tashmat uvray v'rabba v'rishit v'zvil azov sha'alat rabbi Yeshua v'pnei mal turish v'galech kat rosho v'gadel z'knu v'yinshom aval lo nimtza v'shum makom she'yeh v'zeh v'shunam min haga goyim. We don't find any place where there was a distinction in sartorial appearance as far as beards are concerned between Jews and non-Jews. U'masha ramaz l'sifrei mekubalim. And what you found in the books of the Mekubalim, Shekatru Shelola Ushit Yadayim B'Dikni Klal, where it says one should not even touch the beard. Ein li esek b'nistaro. I have nothing to do with this esoteric form of knowledge. But if you insist on bringing the Kabbalah into the picture, aval mehem u'mehamonam, but from the Kabbalists themselves and from their multitudes, you should look into what's happened in Italy. All of the Italian rabbis are clean shaven. They all rely on Menachem Azariah Dafano, the author of the book Aseret Mamarot, Aviha Mekubalim, the head of the Kabbalist movement in Italy, Shehu Hayam Gulach Beli Hashir Sahara Achat. He was completely clean shaven. V'chein heyida lav ha'yashar mekam diya ve'yayalim shelo v'ya omer sh'af al pi chachmei ha'mukubalim ein sh'af al sh'al pi chachmei ha'mukubalim, according to the scholars of the Kabbalah, ein chutz la'aretz u'ya l'kach, that this distinction about interfering with the emanations of God by shaving your beard doesn't apply in chutz la'aretz. And therefore the Italian rabbis, even the Kabbalists amongst them, went clean shaven. U'ma'arich b'masha ein li yad v'shem ba. And why should I go on about something I know nothing about? So as you can see, the Chatam Sofer completely rejects the Kabbalah as any form of source or origin for deciding anything. Aval avoteinu henhigu atzman kein al tzad ha-hechrech ha-gadol ולא מקום עכשיו, חס ושלום בקדושה יתרה, והנה בבני גזרות תתנו at the time of the Crusades, והרואים יתירו את גדוליהם למקטים רגליהם לשנות מלבוש ולגלח סקנם של היקרים הרביהם, כי אז כבר דלכו הרגעים זקניהם על פי מעשה ממלך פולים, אחד שהיה סריס כנגור מסעיף היורים, והתירו חזל שבהם ימיהם לעשות כן. ולהיות גלוח זקן דבר שהיא אשר להשתנות, היו נחלמים מאוד אנשים מהיינו בשובם וביתם, על כן נשתרף המנהג שלא לגדלו כלל, רק סימן הבעלמה שזה יגולח יביל בקוצר זמן שבין לילה. Maybe they look a little unshaven, but they did not wear a beard. היברק אך מפלגי התורה, only the great היושבים בביתם, הם מגדלים אותם. Only the Rabbani who would actually spend all their time in a house and never go out into the world would actually grow a beard. Yotan shelefnei gzeira ahi shebalchu le'eretz Polin lo ba'u leklal ze. Those that escaped Germany and moved into Poland didn't have this custom of shaving the beard. This is an incorrect historical analysis. In fact, the more correct historical analysis was that the Kabbalah held sway in Eastern Europe and never had any sway in Germany, and therefore, and furthermore, as you know, the Goyim also were wearing beards more in Eastern Europe than they were in Western Europe in that period. V'nei zed ba'ov v'nachon, ki ilu haya tchilat min hago v'yisu haya mishum u'chikei ha'goyim, aval ha'cha shekvar nahalu Yisrael ha'galeach, tu ein bo shum nignun u'pikpuk klal. There's not the slightest aspect of prohibition in shaving. Afilu ruach isur engo. Isn't even a smell of prohibition. Aval hachta masani uchmi lo yadati ech nispashe. Al kein tzurichanu lo mitzvot l'mashin l'pashe gam kem b'tchila b'heter b'kevin shu utar utar. V'hine y'ayin b'yurodea tzimu kuchman zayin, etc. etc. V'im yishu mispareim ke'ein tal and the fact that the people are so clean shaven as if they were shaved with a razor, for that we already have an opening from the tshuva of the Tumat HaDeshen that we've already read. Muvavar amar yudeh simkefeh kishazuk chadud meod yish nizaher ulai yachtot v'tachton l'chud yedana shurubi lo shiach gam mehashchatah mitachat agaron amayin v'shas v'oshem yikil mama shlep eman l'chashir v'varen. Etc. I'm just missing something.
In any event, we see very clearly that the most conservative of the halakhic authorities in the 19th century said there's absolutely no reason whatsoever to grow a beard. And and of course, in Frankfurt, and already in most of the Western and Middle Central European countries, they had this terrible powder. I don't know if you remember that. When I was a kid, we had it. Well, I remember, you know, this terrible odor. There was a very bad smell. I remember on Blanty Street, there was a kosher barbershop where we went in two or three times a week. My father would go, because that was before I had a beard. But, you know, you'd go in and they'd put the depilatory on your face and then scrape it off. That was before the invention of the electric razor. But the fact that had already existed a little in some other place in this journal, which I didn't reproduce. Or maybe I skipped over it in reading it. He mentioned this issue. So here's a clear-cut case in which the most conservative of the halakhic authorities in the 19th century said there's no reason whatsoever to wear a beard. The Kabbalistic impulse in Eastern Europe says it's absolutely necessary to wear a beard because cutting of your beard interferes with celestial processes of emanation. Even in Chutzlaritz, except in Italy. And, well, who won? It seems to me pretty clear that the Mekubalim won on this particular issue. In this room you have perhaps even, but the trend certainly in today's world is that to be a really religious Jew, you wear a beard. Seems to me. Is that not true? Well,
it depends on the culture. It depends if you're talking Brooklyn or Brookline.
I'm talking about major Jewish centers, not outposts like Brooklyn.
I thought they had black cats. How does they wait to appall the teacher?
It's very interesting. And we'll come to that. In Professor Katz's book, he has an outline of a biography of the Chatam Sofer. In relation, one has to understand that the Chatam Sofer started from a relatively mildly secularist Jewish community. He was, again, a rebel against his parents and moving very far to the right, being moved by this charismatic figure of Rav Nassim Adler, who's also a very complicated figure, and his own relationship to the Kabbalah is strange. So let's postpone the discussion of the biography of the Chatam Sofer until we have the best practice book. Okay. So that's typical of the kinds of problems that I want to examine. Straight halachic rational analysis says A, the Kabbalah says B, and in many cases it's the Kabbalah that wins rather than the halacha. And part of the reason, of course, is the great advantage if you're doing something that's going to really affect the cosmos, you better do it right. If you're just choosing a particular sartorial style, that's not going to make, you're not going to make such a fuss over it.
How can we say it's against halacha?
I'm saying that there's no halachic requirement to wear a beard.
Yeah, so they didn't talk to any harm by putting wearing a beard. They just doesn't go against halacha. Where do they conflict?
They conflict if you maintain that a person, by shaving, is committing an improper act.
That's only according to the Kabbalistic, not according to halacha.
Right. Right. Let's put it this way. I want you to tell me how many of the Talmidim today of the Chatam Sofer don't have a beard. If you take a look at any of the Hungarian Hasidim of today, or generally the religious Hungarian Jews, do they have beards? You are the exception rather than the rule.
With or without
beards? They're a couple. And they're the exception that proves the rule.
And when they were talking talking about beards, because they told me about beards actually not cutting it at all. Just
not cutting it at all. Like the Taliban today, you get thrown into jail if you touch the beard. Okay. Now, let's go back to some more general considerations.
Well, I mean, just to pick up on Mr. Weinstein's point, I mean, today it's as much, I would posit, it's as much a cultural instinct or influence as it is a halachic one derived from, you know, from the capitalism. It's a rejection of modern society. It is an external differentiation. And so, you know, the observation you make that the quote religious Jews today take it as incumbent upon themselves to have beards is a normative observation, but the roots of that are probably as much cultural as they are quasi-halachic.
Sure. I don't deny that, and some of the things that will come across will be more Kabbalah than more, but of course the origin of this was Kabbalistic. In other words, the Chatham Sofer is making the claim that having a beard or not having a beard was never a distinguishing characteristic of Jew versus non-Jew. So it became a distinguishing characteristic because of the Kabbalistic implication, and then once having become a social marker, it acquired a life of its own. Nothing is static. I mean, certainly today, I would be very surprised if many of those who actually wear beards are familiar at all with the somewhat shocking citations of sexual aspects within the Godhead. However, kabiyachal, they always say, but whether you use that word or not, the notion of male and female forces and so on within the Godhead would seem foreign to any person with a yeshiva education today. These things are simply not taught. But at one time, they were prevalent. And similarly, the notion of emanation having something to do with the beard is something that may have been common coin in the 16th and 17th and 18th century when the Zohar was supreme, and it had no halachic or cultural basis.